Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hello and welcome to Outward, Slate's podcast where we welcome queers and allies of all parties. Dance parties, underwear parties, Tupperware parties, pajama parties. Everyone is welcome. I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and this week we're digging into a topic that I have always found somewhat mysterious and perplexing, the phenomenon of the gay Republican. Now, I want to be clear, I say perplexing not because I think all queers should be capital D Democrats in terms of party affiliation. While that may be the practical thing in our current system in terms of voting, there's a lot to be desired with that party as well. And it's always worth remembering that the Dems only pretty recently came around to supporting LGBTQ equality themselves. But you have to admit that it is undeniably strange to align oneself with a political movement that seems to actively hate you, particularly in a time when that hatred has really freed itself from the shackles of politeness and made its way out into the open into don't say gay style bills and all of that. It's easy to dismiss LGBT Republicans as maybe delusional or hypocritical, but as it turns out, there's a lot more that draws a not insignificant number of queers to conservatism. To help us understand all this, we're joined today by the writer and historian Neil J. Young, who's written a fascinating book titled Coming Out Republican, A History of the Gay Right. Neil's book is the landmark account of this group, and it's a much-needed, richly told addition to not only the history of the right in America, but to LGBTQ history in general. Because as we will discuss, gay Republicans have been far more influential in our movement than we give them credit for, even if their particular path has led us to a world where neo-fascist MAGA gays are out here fighting woke and Caitlyn Jenner is appearing regularly on Fox News. We'll be back with that conversation and with Neil right after a little break. The new Star series Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week. One of the meals that I had was mushroom chicken thighs and wild rice. To have something genuinely delicious and can be heated up in 2 minutes, I mean, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon. You can also customize customize your weekly meals, and you have the flexibility to get as little or as much as you need. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long, so look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/outward50 and use code OUTWARD50 to get 50% off of your first box, plus 20% off of your next box. That's code OUTWARD50 at factormeals.com/outward50 to get 50% off of your first box, plus 20% off of your next box while your subscription is active.
Neil Young is the author previously of We Gather Together, The Religious Right, and The Problem of Interfaith Politics. His work has appeared in publications including The New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Los Angeles Times, and Slate. And he co-hosts the history podcast Past Present. I'm so excited to have you on the show today, Neil. Welcome to Outward.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
This book is really incredible. I really can't praise it enough. And it's not something that I thought I would necessarily be as excited about given the subject matter. So I think that really speaks to what you've accomplished just in your writing and your storytelling. And I want our listeners to understand that it really is a book full of stories. It's history, but it really comes alive with the stories of the particular figures that you choose to sort of tell that history through. So I really hope our listeners will go pick it up just for that entertainment aspect, if not for the education. So I thought we would start our conversation before we really get into the meat of the book. I always like to hear from an author what drew them to their project, sort of on a personal level before we get into the project. And I'm really interested here because you write this in a straightforward historical way. It's not, editorializing a lot or a lot of judgment. And you leave most of the conclusions to us, to the reader. But, it is clear that you're not maybe exactly approving of gay Republicans at all moments anyway. So I'm curious what drove you to want to take this project on.
It's been interesting to hear people's reactions to it and how they've differed. And I think, it speaks to their vantage points as readers. This is not a memoir. I am not a gay Republican. I want to make that clear because, there's lots of assumptions built into a project like this when you put it out into the world. But I did grow up in a Republican family.
Right.
And that shaped, my first project about the history of the religious right. This is an idea I have had in mind for well over 20 years. I was someone who went off to college, came out of the closet, shifted my politics. I'm compressing history here, but I think it's a familiar arc that a lot of people have.
Sure.
Yeah. Certainly a lot of people around me, a lot of my friends in college were doing the same. And I moved to New York City right after college where I lived for, some 20 years and started meeting these guys who were bankers and consultants and who told me, they were libertarians. And one of them told me that he belonged to this organization called Log Cabin Republicans. And this was the early 2000s, just the beginning of the first Bush administration. And it was also the same years that that organization was becoming nationally prominent. So I started hearing about it more in the news and such. And I just sort of filed it away as an interesting idea, potentially a second book project, but one that got really delayed for a long time. It was sort of put on the back burner of my mind. Two things happened in 2019 that made it come to the forefront and maybe made me do this project now. One is Pete Buttigieg running for president.
Sure.
Now, obviously not a Republican, but someone who is running as, at the time, a sort of centrist Democrat.
Exactly.
Was getting attacked a lot from the left, particularly from the LGBTQ left. I wrote a couple of columns about that at the time, and I started to think, we need a bigger narrative history here of LGBTQ people that isn't a history of progressive politics, that wrestles with the larger political spectrum that LGBTQ people belong to. And so that was part of it. And then also in 2019, both the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee, in preparation for the 2020 election, they both started doing outreach efforts to LGBTQ voters.
Now, I
view that very cynically in the book, but I also recognized it was historically significant. And so those two incidents made me want to delve into this history and to do this project now. Little did I know everything that was coming down the pipeline as I was writing this that made it all the more interesting and urgent.
No, urgent's true. I mean, even just reading the last bit of the book and the conclusion, it's like, you can only be so current in a book that's filed at a certain time. But one of the things that I wanted to sort of start with, just to sort of situate our listeners, is the values that you sort of trace through the history of the gay right, because they evolve sort of in conversation with the party itself and what the party is doing and espousing with the larger public. But I thought it would be good to just sort of define those core beliefs that you see at the beginning in the 1950s and you see them taken through. So could you just do that for us?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a group that changes a lot over time, as I show in this book. And even in moments, there's diversity within this demographic I'm looking at. But there are really three core philosophical tenets that I think span this period, which is one, a firm adherence to fiscal conservatism, generally meaning lower taxes, less government spending, sort of limited government in general. Secondly, robust appreciation and advocacy for national security politics, and especially through the military, sort of aggressive foreign policy posture. Also, after the 1980s, increasing appreciation for an advocacy of law enforcement, which is not true for the decades prior to that, which we can maybe talk about. And then lastly, this firm defense of individual rights.
Right.
Now, that's a discourse that's really expansive, and it can mean all sorts of different things, as I show in the book. Sometimes it includes their notions of gay rights. Other times, it's a sort of conservative anti-identity position. But that discourse and that politics of individual rights is one that I think you see over this 70-year period that I'm writing about.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see how that what that can encompass and how it sort of shifts over time. Another, I think, thing that we need to make clear at the start, and that you make very clear throughout the book, is the demographics of this group. Like, we're really talking about a specific group of people with some, you know, other folks on the edges, but really it's a core group. I think you should define that for our listeners too, because it influences the politics, right? Like, the background of these guys, I'm going to say, influences the politics.
Yeah, this is a book almost entirely and a history almost entirely of white gay men.
Right.
You know, the subtitle is A History of the Gay Right, which the working title, I think, was, you know, something about LGBTQ conservatism. And certainly the broader terrain of this book that I reference, you know, throughout is the LGBTQ right.
Mm-hmm.
But the bulk of this study is about gay white men, because they were at the forefront of the organizations, most importantly Log Cabin Republicans,
right,
but other organizations I look at, and also at the forefront of the sort of the public persons who were the spokespersons and the figureheads and the media figures who have been seen through this period. And that was frustrating me as I was doing this research, because I thought, my gosh, you know, I wanted to write a book with much more diverse characters. Like, where are the women? Where are the persons of color? I was doing everything I could to bring them into the narrative, and there are some here. But then I realized, obviously, as a historian, the evidence speaks for itself.
Yeah.
This is a movement, and these were organizations. They were overwhelmingly, we're talking about above 90% in many of the cases, of white gay men. And so then this actually became fundamental to the argument. What does it mean? What does the whiteness mean? What does the maleness mean for the larger politics that they were advocating, and also for the relationship with the Republican Party and conservatism more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so clear, just to you know, say it bluntly, that a commitment to individualism is a lot easier when you are a white gay man, right? So that's something that sort of you can trace through the book. So let's go back to the beginning. One thing that this book does that I think is really, really important, and this is a frustration of mine in general, is that the origins of the modern gay rights movement are not Stonewall. They're not the anti-police sort of radical mood that happened there in 1969. Actually, the movement begins about 20 years before that, and really under pretty conservative auspices, right? We're talking about the homophile movement, the Mattachine Society. And in that environment, in that sort of moment in time, a lot of the people who were doing that, you know, sort of beginnings of activism, were conservative people, right? So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the story of Dor Legg, which is a character we see, you know, throughout the book, but particularly at the beginning. And who were those people at the beginning of what we now call the gay rights movement?
Yeah, so my book begins in the 1950s in the era of the closet, the Lavender Scare. But the opening chapter is about this man named Dor Legg, who grew up in Michigan in a Republican family, very libertarian family, small business owners, and had a sort of don't tread on me politics. He moves out to Los Angeles, here where I live, in the early 1940s, and he moves in part because he was arrested in Detroit. He liked to date black men, and being a white man walking around with groups of black men attracted the police and the vice squad's attention.
Right.
And so he's arrested in Michigan. He thinks, you know, what in the world? Isn't this supposed to be a free country? I'm going to move out to California, the land of freedom, of opportunity, of tolerance. And he becomes one of the first members of he's not a founding member, but he's a very early member of the Mattachine Society. And then he is part of a group that's kind of a bunch of right of center guys who break away from Mattachine. Mattachine had a sort of communist to it because of its founder, Harry Hay, and also because a lot of the members were also members of the Communist Party USA, although it contained a broad swath of politics. But these right of center guys break away. They found their own organization called One Inc., and it publishes one of the most important magazines of this era, homophile magazines of this era.
And it's created one of the most important archives for anybody that's doing queer history now. This was such a fascinating connection, right, that one is related to this guy, yeah.
Exactly. But he has a right of center politics. He believes that the pathway towards freedom is in limiting the government. This is not a surprising position to take when you're in the midst of a lavender scare, when the entire apparatus of the federal government is being directed to surveilling, harassing, criminalizing, and imprisoning gay persons.
Listeners may remember when we talked about Fellow Travelers, the show a few episodes ago, that this is the period that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's such a great reference point for this very era. And I think it did a great job bringing this to life. You know, so he thinks that the pathway to freedom isn't, you know, with a rights-based consciousness movement. It's in limiting government, restraining powers, and letting people live their lives freely without government harassment. And he eventually, you know, some 20 plus years later, is one of the founding members of the Log Cabin Club that begins in Los Angeles in the late 1970s.
Yeah. And it's fascinating because, you know, again, in my intro, I sort of said something about looking at these people as hypocrites or as delusional. But actually, you made me feel a different feeling, which is that these folks were brave in a lot of ways. There is a bravery present, especially at this sort of beginning era, in the actions and the choices that these folks made, like Legg. Can you talk a little bit about that sense of bravery that you clearly saw there? Because it just comes through in the writing.
I'm glad you say that, because that was something that I think surprised me in researching this and writing it, but realized it was really true. And it was something that I wanted to highlight in the narrative, particularly in these early decades. My tone definitely shifts as we get closer to present. But in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, for these guys to come out of the closet, for them to risk everything to do so, for them to come out of the closet also to challenge governmental power. You know, One Inc. sues the federal government.
Right.
And they win.
Right.
It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. This is one of the most fundamental cases of the 20th century that establishes LGBTQ freedom.
This is the case about being able to mail their magazine, right?
The U.S. Post Office was constantly shutting down the publication. They went and distribute it, and they charged the magazine with obscenity. And One Inc. took this case. Mm-hmm. They tried to get the ACLU to help them out with this, and the ACLU would not do this. Yeah. So just giving you a sense of the politics here, and One Inc. pursued it nevertheless on First Amendment grounds, and they won that case. And that established a incredibly foundation of freedom that really shaped the second half of the 20th century around LGBTQ rights, but also around just First Amendment rights in general. Unbelievable bravery from these folks, especially because one of the things I'm constantly contrasting, a lot of this story, especially in the early decades, is set in California.
Right.
And you have all these out gay men in California who are risking a lot to be out, to challenge, you know, the government's oppression of them, and also to challenge the Republican Party to include them in it. Mm-hmm. And those are set against a different sort of actors in my book, which are the closeted gay Republicans in Washington, D.C., who are hiding their lives, often through, you know, being married to women or what else, because they're pursuing power for themselves. They're pursuing professional advantage, and less so any sense of gay rights. And so that was a sort of, it was interesting to see these two sets of people sort of set against each other through these decades. And I think it only highlights the bravery of a lot of these actors.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to jump ahead a little bit. And this question is going to be a bit of a crossover to another Slate podcast. You may know that on Slow Burn, the upcoming season is going to be about the Briggs Initiative. And so there's a wonderful chapter about the Briggs Initiative in your book. And I also thought that it was useful to talk about that moment because it really captures, I think, some of the main tensions that you're tracing sort of throughout the evolution of the gay right One is this sort of sense of privacy versus visibility as being values, and especially, you know, the mainstream gay movement is moving towards visibility here. The gay right is more interested in privacy. Also, this distinction between being an interest group versus an identity sort of community, right? And so in Briggs, we have, I'll let you tell the story, but in Briggs, we basically have a Republican in California wanting to block gay teachers from teaching in the classroom. Is it broader than that, actually, but that's sort of the meat of it. And so the gay Republicans there have to activate around this, right? Because they don't want that to happen. So tell us about that story briefly, because we're going to have a whole season about it later. Yeah. But also how you see the sort of self-definition playing out, because I felt like it was really relevant there.
Yeah. So John Briggs is a state legislator, a Republican state legislator from Orange County, California. He puts forward this ballot proposition, becomes known as the Briggs Initiative, that, as you said, would have made it illegal for gay persons to work in the public school system of California. This is in 1978. And gay Republicans in large part start coming out of the closet to organize against this. And this is where the first log cabin clubs are formed in San Francisco and Los Angeles in order to organize people against the Briggs Initiative. But one of the things you point to is an ongoing internal debate among these gay Republicans of what it is that they represent.
Yeah.
Like, what is the politics that they're advocating for? Is it visibility? Is it recognition? Or is it just leave us alone?
Right.
And that's the sort of invisibility politics, right? Like, don't come after us. Like, let's get rid of these discriminatory laws, but we're not asking for any rights. As opposed to some who are saying, you know, we need to be visible in the party, because in order to be visible in the party, they'll recognize that gay persons are Republicans, mm-hmm. we're hard workers for the GOP, and therefore, they'll extend to us things like employment protection and allow us to serve in the military and eventually the right to marriage. So that's like an ongoing debate within this larger movement that never really goes away.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back more from Neil about gay Republicans right after that. All right, we're back. Neil, I wanted to ask about this idea of gay family values. So you take us up to the 80s and to the AIDS crisis, and the gay right sort of has to take an interesting turn there. One thing that you show us that I did not know, and I think this is really interesting, is that it was gay Republican groups who were some of the first to activate around the AIDS crisis, right? To do fundraising and to raise the alarm about it, when some other groups were less eager to do that, for wanting to protect things like bathhouses and that kind of thing, at least at first. There's also a broader kind of ideological turn among gay Republicans to claiming family values as their own. And those values might be like monogamy, being relationship oriented, and sort of a sense that somehow gays could help stabilize the country. So tell us a little bit about that, because it's kind of a funny phrase, family values, but it really did. It really was a major shift.
Absolutely. This was such a fascinating period for me to research and to write about, because there is such an enormous transformation in a very short period of time of the politics here. So gay Republicans in the early 80s, especially in San Francisco, mm-hmm. the first gay Republican organization that still is existing to this day was called Concerned Republicans for Individual Rights. It's now known as Log Cabin Republicans of San Francisco. It's founded in 1978. It has 250 members in the mid-80s, making it the largest Republican organization in the entire city of San Francisco. In the early years, it holds the very first fundraiser for HIV in the city of San Francisco in the early 80s. And it started wrestling with the epidemic really early on, before a lot of other gay organizations even wanted to acknowledge it or grapple with it. There was a Republican governor of California at the time, and this organization believed its duty was to provide him information and education and to serve as an advocacy group around the policy decisions he could make about HIV. And then, as you say, this organization also defended the bathhouses staying open in San Francisco mm-hmm. when the Democratic-led city officials and the public health department tried to shut them down. Yeah. And they were advocating around a discourse of personal freedom, which is really different than the sort of discourse of the left of sexual freedom. They meant personal freedom to be, I can do what I want with my body. I know what the risks are. I should be allowed to take them as an individual. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. also, the government shouldn't shut down businesses. Now, by the late 80s, they start moving away from this position. Yeah. In large part because the epidemic has been so deadly. Mm-hmm. It's decimated the organization itself, as it has of every gay community. And also, it has inflamed a horrific homophobic politics on the right within the Republican Party. And since their larger strategy is to improve their standing within the GOP, they think, okay, we cannot be the voices of the bathhouse is staying open because, you know, we're for free enterprise. And so they adopt what I call a gay family values discourse that sort of accommodates the larger social conservatives' family values discourse of the era, but articulates it in a way that's, you know, not homophobic, but is predicated on monogamy, on relationships, on marriage. This is when they start advocating that gays need to be allowed to get married, because if we get married, these are their words, we won't be promiscuous, we'll curtail our sexual activity, and that will be a benefit to public health, and that will help stabilize the nation. So that's the sort of direction it heads into, and I think that only sets up the really conservative turn that gay Republicans take in the 1990s that I write about and the years that follow.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that's where I want to go next, because this is, you know, if it's interesting, from the 50s to maybe the 80s, there is a sense, for me speaking, this is, I'm speaking personally, I felt maybe a little more understanding or a little more empathy for this position, even though it's not, you know, not one that I would hold. But there was stuff to admire, right? Like the bravery we were talking about, and certainly the AIDS activism. But after that, things take a turn, I think. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's how I felt about it. Particularly, you frame it in terms of victimhood and grievance. You talk about how the gay right made this turn toward victimhood and grievance in terms of how they, the rhetoric and sort of how they talked about themselves within the larger LGBT movement and otherwise. And you did this very helpful thing for me, which was to connect it to the sort of white male grievance politics that have come to be. I mean, the Republican Party is that now, like that's what the party is about. And so I had not made that connection before, but maybe you can make it for our listeners.
That's right. Yeah. I think especially in that decade, in the 90s, the movement becomes a lot more conservative for a bunch of reasons, in large part because those libertarian folks of the early years are almost all killed off by the HIV crisis. And there's a different generation that comes along in the 90s and the 2000s. They're sort of post-Reagan babies, post-HIV AIDS, you know, to the extent that they're living in a different historical moment. And their politics reflect that. And I think one of the things you start seeing developing in the in these years is the language of, it was harder for me to come out as a Republican than it was for me to come out as gay. This becomes an increasing talking point on the gay right. It actually goes back to the 80s, but really it starts ramping up in the 2000s. And I think it's a talking point that is specially well engineered for a conservative media sphere that is, you know, expanding in this period. And also in an era in which public attitudes about homosexuality, including on the right, are changing so quickly. Right. So when, you know, a majority of Americans and even eventually a majority of Republicans start to express some sort of levels of tolerance for homosexuality and even, you know, increasing levels of support for gay rights, you know, as tied to marriage and employment protection, it becomes really politically useful for gay persons on the right to go on Fox News or to write an article for Breitbart and to say, it was harder for me to come out as a Republican than it was for me to come out as gay, because it does two things. It says the gay rights movement is over, mission accomplished. Right. Y'all don't need to worry about this anymore. We are not oppressed. We're not, you know, there's not bigotry we have to face.
It's done.
That, you know, it's done. And also, what is the larger thing that it's saying is Republicans, they are the most oppressed group. And by way of that, we mean, what do we really mean? White, heterosexual, Christian men. So it's a sort of transference, right, that allows the broader conservative grievance politics and victimhood politics to have a certain edge to it because it's being validated by gay persons.
This is about the time in history where I start covering gay politics and writing about it in my own career. And you bring us to this really harrowing moment that's kind of the end result of what you were just talking about. This really harrowing moment sort of in the mid-teens of Milo Yiannopoulos and the sort of weaponization of gay people, of as he would put it, faggotry and camp, even camp sensibility. Around Trump and to sort of, you know, legitimize the right in certain ways. Can you just, it's a painful thing for me to remember because it was just so awful, but, and gave me nightmares for a long time. But tell us a little bit about that moment and just how that was kind of the apotheosis of what you were just talking about.
Yeah. I mean, this was actually a really difficult chapter to write because it was just so grim. Yeah. These characters are really horrible. And there was folks that I didn't even know about, like Jack Donovan, who are white nationalists, gay men, and who are, you know, close with Richard Spencer.
Mask for mask taken to the, like, worst possible
Absolutely.
Place.
Barbarian for barbarian is what he would probably say. But, you know, Milo obviously had a much, I mean, had a huge public voice within these decades. And he was really pushing the sort of politics of outrage that was really campy, right? Like that he was bringing this sort of camp sensibility to Breitbart and to the far right media sphere, to Twitter. But again, doing it on behalf of white heterosexual men. His way of sort of mainstreaming or even just sort of introducing misogyny through the homosexual voice and also racism was, I think, really fascinating to look at from the vantage point of now and to understand how he was at the forefront of sort of pushing this edge into, you know, from the edge of sort of the far right media sphere into mainstream conservative politics and conservative media. You know, Milo is really central to that.
You're looking back on that and remembering that was just wild because he got away with so much and it like you said, it got mainstreamed, right? It was this like Pepe the Frog like craziness that now is just completely taken over, you know, that discourse. You leave us with the consideration of how gay Republicans have turned, like, along with their party against trans people, right? That's sort of the moment that we live in right now. Certainly over the last 8 years or so, they've done that. What do you think history teaches us about that kind of what I would see as a betrayal and a turn against our own people? And they certainly don't see it that way. But what do you think your research and history has shown about that kind of decision?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, it just exemplifies an ongoing tension of this movement that we see throughout the history, which is like, who are we? What is our community? Yeah. Do we have an identity? Are we an interest group? How expansive is this community? And so I think it's not surprising that you have gay Republicans today, and Log Cabin is among this, who say, we are for trans rights. And by that we mean, you know, we stand for individual freedom for adults to live their lives in any way they want. And we support the legislation and Supreme Court decisions that have been around protecting, you know, that have given employment protections and those sorts of things to adults. But we distinguish that from what they are calling the radical gender ideology that's being imposed on children.
Right.
And it's worth noting that that sort of distinction or that delineation, I think, squares with large, maybe even majority of Americans around these issues. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they are radical outliers here at all. And in a way that this politics spans, you know, beyond just the Republican Party. But I think the thing that I kept asking, I interviewed almost 3 dozen people for this book. And the thing I kept asking current gay Republicans is, do you have any fears of where this is headed? I understand the distinction you're making, but do you have any fears of where this is headed? This is an opening wedge of a broader assault on LGBTQ rights. And all of them said, no, absolutely not. These are distinct legislative moments. Mm. These are particular pieces of legislation. This is not part of a broader assault. And I think that was a very ahistorical notion of their own history that I found really shocking. And we'll see how this all plays out. Obviously, I don't know what the future holds, but the sense that there was no sort of worry about what they might be involved in facilitating, I think is really, to me, surprising. And I'll just say quickly to wrap up, you know, this organization, as I think my book shows, and I'm talking about both Log Cabin Republicans and the broader gay right, over the course of their history, they really operated as the thorn in the side of the Republican Party, prompting it to do what was right, holding its feet to the fire, calling it out for its homophobic actions, and moving it in a direction of broader freedom. What I think has happened in the Trump era is a complete collapse into insider status that is one to facilitate Trumpism, to be an inside player as opposed to an outside provoker. And that's an enormous transformation of this movement. And I think that is one that we see sort of most visibly through the trans issue right now.
Neil, this is a fantastic conversation. The book is just incredible. I hope our listeners will go pick it up, even if you are not a gay Republican. I don't know how many of them listen to us, but I learned a lot, and it really filled out like a blind spot in my understanding of gay history. So pick it up. The book is called Coming Out Republican, A History of the Gay Right. It is written by Neil J. Young. Neil, thank you for being on Outward.
Thank you. It was great to be here. I really appreciate it.
that is the show for this week. Please send us feedback about it and topic ideas for other shows you'd like to hear to outwardpodcast@slate.com, or you can try us at Facebook or on X at Slate Outward. Just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Working, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show has been produced this week by the fabulous Paula Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app. Tell your friends and family and lovers and enemies about it, and have them all rate and review the show so that everybody can join in on the fun. Until next week, stay gay, everybody.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.